The Woj Pod is brought to you by Goodyear, helping you discover the road ahead. Goodyear, more driven.
Hey everyone, welcome into another edition of the Woj Pod. Here with Toronto Raptors coach Nick Nurse, the 2019-2020 NBA Coach of the Year, obviously the coach of the championship Raptor season in 18-19, which is largely the focus of his new book called Rapture that is released this week online and in bookstores. Great visit with Raptors coach Nick Nurse.
You can now stream the most MLB games on DirecTV without a satellite dish. Yes, catch the clutch hits, strikeouts, grand slams, web gems with nothing on your roof. So whoever's up there, whether it's roofers, Santa, birds, old-timey chimney sweeps, moody teenagers, thrill-seeking raccoons, you name it, they won't find a satellite dish. But you will find your MLB games on DirecTV. That means DirecTV is your home for baseball this season. Root, root, root with nothing on your roof. Yes, stream your team. Call 1-800-DIRECTV or visit DirecTV.com. Sign up today. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package.
Nick Nurse, the head coach of the Toronto Raptors, the NBA's Coach of the Year, the owner of a lengthy and pretty lucrative new contract extension, and also the author of a new book. It was released yesterday, in fact, on Monday. It is called Rapture, 15 Teams, 4 Countries, 1 NBA Championship, and How to Win Damn Near Anywhere by Nick Nurse and co-written with Michael Sokolov. Nick, it is great to have you here. How are you?
I'm good, Woj. Always great to speak with you. Thanks for taking the time and having me on. Appreciate it.
Absolutely. The last time I think we talked, you were spinning around the bubble on your bike before Game 7 against the Celtics. It was a ritual for a couple coaches, you and Mike Malone, who both were involved in long series there and were down there a long time. On game day, I saw both of you guys just spinning around the lake, and it was a way to get out of your room and about really the only thing to do outside, right?
Yeah, it was a game day ritual. It didn't feel right to do really anything else. There wasn't much else to do. I suppose you could have done some other stuff, but the bike seemed pretty close, and just in case the weather turned, you could get off it and get back to your room or whatever. So it was, nice bikes, and it was a pretty. I had a perfect 1 mile loop I carved out, so I just kept going around and around that whenever I, felt like, game day, clearing the cobwebs out a little bit.
Raptors advanced to the conference semifinal at Game 7 with Boston, and before. Bowing out, and obviously Boston went on to lose to Miami in the conference finals. How much of the playoffs did you watch after you left and got home, Nick?
Well, not very much, Woj. I dabbled in the West a bit. I did not watch the East. Mm-hmm. it was, it's a getting over it process. It really is. I mean, as you know, you get up every morning all season long, and you're putting your heart and your guts and your soul into this thing. And when it ends before you want it to, it's hard to take those losses. And especially when you get down to really a 7-game series that one possession, we had a shot to tie it at the end of regulation there, and that made it a close series. It was tough to go out that way. So no, I haven't watched much. I did watch the finals. I was kind of over my my issues of watching basketball and enjoyed the finals, and just realized again how hard it is for those teams to win it. It's that point really got driven home with me watching the finals.
Nick, do you have a better appreciation? You've been out of the bubble for about a month now. Your season ended on September 11th, of how difficult it was to navigate trying to advance and win in there, and all the preparation that goes into that and the intensity that goes into that. But at the same time, there were moments and instances in the bubble where several teams, including yours, thought about, do we want to continue? Do we want to pack up and leave? And after the Jacob Blake, the shooting in Wisconsin, it was a tipping point for a lot of teams. What was the balancing act like that for you as a head coach in that environment?
Well, I think, Woj, it's been quite a balancing act since March 11th. And I think that the biggest thing was is not to plan or not to put too rigidly together your plans, because I think there's been so much changing of the directions or information or whatever. So let's go back to March 11th, and 2 weeks after that, we're not playing and players want to know what's going on. Well, you're giving them as much information as you can, but you don't really have very good information because that's changing day to day about what's going to happen. And I think it was similar. Nobody really knew what it was going to be like in the bubble, right? So you kind of went down there with an idea and you kind of lay out some of that stuff for them. But again, in any communications you were having in front of the team, you were kind of saying, hey, let's be open-minded. Let's be positive. Let's look at the bright side. Let's get out of bed on the right side of the bed every day. You know, just things to say, hey, it's going to be jostling. Now to get to your question, when the play stopped, and we were again at the point of what's going to happen next, we were just doing our best to navigate through it, listen to them about why they wanted to stop and what they wanted to do, give my own opinion on what I thought, how I saw it from my shoes and how I saw everything, but not making it a mandate, of course. It was just more like discussions and trying to help and lead and be there, put an arm around them, give them an open forum to speak, and then we'll handle the decisions as they come at us.
People will remember the Bucks making the decision to boycott their playoff game with Orlando, and it triggered a series of teams that day and shut the bubble down for a few days. I think perhaps lost in that was that the Raptors and Celtics were talking, I think within their own team, and I think a little bit within between the teams, about doing that exact same thing. What do you remember about the walk-up prior to the start of your series with Boston and then the decision Milwaukee made? Did you go to bed any of those nights wondering if your team was going to play that game one as scheduled or that there was going to be a different decision made?
No, I think there was we had some real serious talk about it as a team, Woj, and I think it was in the balance about whether we were going to play or not. And I think, I think the Bucks decision, obviously spearheaded the whole thing, and everybody kind of had to follow suit, or the league did, and figure out where we were going with this whole thing. But I think those were serious talks, and I think there was some, Brad and I were exchanging texts about what was happening and trying to keep each other updated. And yeah, there was a real possibility that series wasn't going to happen.
Which is pretty unbelievable when you think about, you're getting ready to compete against a team and to be having those kinds of conversations. It was strange enough, I know, for people to be in the same hotel, be bumping into each other all the time in what was a heightened competitive environment, especially when you get in the playoffs. It sort of just became part of being an NBA coach, because you guys, yeah, as a group, the 30 plus and some other coaches, had gotten very, with the Coaches Association and becoming very involved or more involved in the social justice issues and how you were going to handle it as a coaches association. Then you get to the bubble and the interaction among coaches is just unprecedented for a playoff environment.
Yeah.
It felt.
Yeah. I had a hard time with it, Woj. I gotta be honest with you. I think that there's a level of competitiveness kind of deep inside you that you're at, and it isn't bumping into the head coach on the day of the game in the hallway and trying to have a nice conversation with him. I didn't like not being able to not have a nice conversation either, because respect these guys, and if you bump into them, you know, you rarely bump into them during the course of a normal season. And when you do, you have very pleasant conversations with them. It was uncomfortable for me. I think some, I don't know. I would imagine a lot of the coaches felt the same way, but especially like you said, it was just too often, too much, too often, too, like you said, on my bike ride, I'd see Brad out there walking. I'd see him out there walking every other game or something. And just like, should I wave to him or not wave to him? so it was just kind of weird that way. But, you know, everybody was going through it. So there's certainly no excuses. It just was uncomfortable.
The amount of time that teams had to spend with each other, I was surprised there wasn't more. There was a lot made of, Marcus Smart in the Miami series, going in the locker room, kind of blowing up with some teammates. They were down 2-0 and that kind of thing happens all the time in the postseason. It really does. It just happened that people could hear it in the hallway. And, sometimes as a reporter, you hear about it after. That's normal. I actually was surprised. And I know that I'm sure there are plenty of things going on that we didn't find out about and didn't report on. But I thought there would be more guys just so tired of each other and so at nerve's end, especially as the environment and the intensity of the environment heightened with what was happening outside the bubble too, that there wasn't more of that in there, and that guys were just so sick of each other and seeing each other and being around. Even if you're on the road together in the playoffs, like, you all could go to different places for dinner. You don't have to be around everybody all the time. And then when you're home, you go to practice, you do your treatment, and then you go home. There was no leaving each other in the bubble. I thought the players handled it all in all better than, I would have if you put me on top of everybody I work with all the time.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think they probably handled it better than they did outside the bubble, to your point that you're making. And I think, well, the only thing I'd come up with, my opinion on it would be there was a lot of the other stresses taken out of it, being in the bubble, travel, the late nights, dealing with tickets, dealing with, whatever, just a lot of interactions that cause a little, more tiredness through a day. And I think the tiredness is what always gets everybody in the end. That's where, guys are cranky, and that's when they have those they have those bust ups or dust ups or whatever they are. So I don't know. I think the ability for guys to recuperate and get a lot of rest, I think, has helped the level of play, even under strange circumstances.
NBA fans, listen up. You've got to try Pick 6, the newest fantasy app from DraftKings, an official partner of the NBA. Getting started is simple. Select if a player will have more or less of a stat. For example, will a player have more than one rebound, or will a player have less than 3.5 assists? Pick your favorite players and compete for huge cash prizes. Download the new DraftKings Pick 6 app now using code PARLAY and take on the competition with your best NBA player picks. Only on DraftKings Pick 6 with code PARLAY. The crown is yours. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 18 plus in most eligible states. Age varies by jurisdiction. Eligibility restrictions apply. Pick 6 not available in all states, including but not limited to Connecticut and New York. For up-to-date lists of states, visit dkng.co/pick6states. Void where prohibited. See terms at pick6.draftkings.com/promos.
Nick, you mentioned March 11th and the day that the league shut down and the uncertainty that came after it. March 11th, you were in Toronto at that Hotel X, where I remember seeing you at Masai Ujiri's Mandela 100th anniversary event a couple of years ago. And the Nick Nurse Foundation was having an evening, right? And what you, and to fast forward it, today you are announcing, you guys have announced or are announcing that Julius Erving is going to be on your board of directors, which I want to hear more about. But the Nick Nurse Foundation that night was having an event when you got the news. Tell me, first I want to hear more about Dr. J being a part of this now and what the foundation does. But I would imagine that March 11th moment stays with everybody, and being in that environment, I'm sure even amplified it more for you.
Yeah, it was our kickoff night of the Nick Nurse Foundation, Woj, and it was fun. We had music is a big part of what the foundation does, providing opportunities for kids to learn and play music. And it was a night of music. We had several artists there, John Vinyl. We had a Daniel Caesar award winner. And we had the Arkells as kind of the headliner. And you guys know I dabble and play a couple things. I played four or five songs with them as the close of the thing. But you're right, it was about 9:30. Myself and the Arkells were just about ready to take the stage, and the text come across that Rudy Gobert tested positive, and everybody was like, well, what do we do? And I said, well, we're going to go knock out these four or five songs here real quick. And then we're going to figure it out. And, you know, but you're right. It was a memorable, like everybody still sang. You know, the last night we really did anything was that March 11th at your foundation night. So anyway, we got it kicked off. We raised a bunch of money. You mentioned Dr. J has joined us, and that's awesome. Just met him, one of my high school teammates, a guy by the name of Frank Moloch, knows the doc and put us together. And we went to dinner in Atlanta a while back and just stayed in touch. And I'm excited. I mean, geez, what a legendary guy and player, obviously, you know, an internationally known guy. And we're excited. We're just trying to build this foundation out and make it as good as we can be. I think that's a tremendous addition for it. So we got a doctor and a nurse on the Nick Nurse Foundation.
Very good.
We're off and running. Yeah,
it's just what you guys talked about when you were playing high school basketball in Iowa. I'm going to coach. I'm going to win an NBA championship as a coach. And then someday you're going to introduce me to Dr. J. That's what you talked about on the bus rides through Iowa.
Yeah, through Arcadia, Iowa. Frank Moloch, my friend's from Arcadia, Iowa, population 350. And it's 9 miles away from Carroll, where I'm from, population 10,000. We were on the rides back and forth to his house. We were talking about that. It's like I had another buddy of mine who was at game six in Golden State when we won it last year. And he was right there. And he goes, do you realize you just were on the TV with Kevin McHale, Isaiah Thomas, and Grant Hill interviewing you, man? He's like it kind of hits home, man.
Yeah.
It hits home.
Well, that theme is a big part of your book. Again, the title is Rapture, 15 Teams, 4 Countries, 1 NBA Championship, and How to Win Damn Near Anywhere. Books available probably online. I don't know where there are bookstores open. Obviously easier to get everything that way now. But I've read a good deal of it. I just got a copy last night. And so I went through, and it's a great read. Your co-author, Michael Sokolov, is a great writer, somebody who I've read, I mentioned to you before we went on, his Pete Rose book years ago. He's really an accomplished writer, and I thought he captured your voice and knowing you. It's a great window into your career and how you look at coaching and the profession. One thing I want to ask you about, which I thought was, and you've talked a little bit about this, but you got into it at length in there, and you talk about riding around. There's a scene in the book that you're telling about going to visit Phil Jackson in Montana and spitting cherry pits out the window of a pickup truck. Again, just like you always imagined you would do with Phil Jackson someday. How did you end up with Phil Jackson? And as you describe in there, you went and spent really 3 full days with him out in the hinterlands. What was that like? What did you learn with him?
Yeah, first of all, Alex McKechnie, our director of sports science, worked for Phil as the Lakers. Literally the day I got the head coaching job, Alex sauntered into the office and says, hey, you want to go meet Phil? I said, heck yes, I do. And swapped it out, got it set up. I flew into Montana. I didn't really know if we were going for a cup of coffee, Woj, or if I was staying, you know, what we were really doing. I booked a few days. I had been on kind of a nonstop whirlwind since I got the head coaching job. I figured if we were just going for a 1 hour cup of coffee, I'd stay there a couple days in beautiful Montana and recharge a little bit. But we met at a coffee shop. We have coffee for about an hour and a half or so. He says, hey, jump in my truck. We get in his truck. He goes down the road about a half a mile. It's cherry season. He pulls over, grabs his grabs this big ass bag of cherries and throws them in the middle of us, and he rolls down the windows, and we start driving through the area of Montana, and he's pretty much given me a history lesson of the area and how he spent time there as a kid. We're eating cherries and spitting the seeds out the window, and just like you think, I'm like shaking my head to myself, thinking this is unbelievable. And really, the connection for me, well, started when I was back in England. I went there in 95. This is pre-internet, and where you could just grab any game you want online or whatever. And I was searching for basketball to study because I was a young 26, 27-year-old coach, whatever I was. And I found a place that would send me VHS tapes. And I ordered the Chicago Bulls. My team was running the triangle offense. I was trying to study that and run this. And I ended up watching these tapes like each game 20 times. There was no other basketball to watch. And I was just over and over in my hotel room I was living in at the time, and ended up like Phil kind of was my mentor he didn't really know it, but I'm just studying everything he's doing, and we're running the offense of that. So it was really special for me to be able to kind of tell him that, you know, for 4 or 5 years when I was coaching in England, I really watched like every game he coached, and I was really studying the offense, and we ran it for about 8 or 9 years. So it was kind of, I don't know, I didn't really answer your question about what I learned from him, but I learned a great deal in those years. And then when I was out there, he gave me a lot of the spiritual stuff, man, the basketball gods, the making the decision, best decisions for the team. You know, that's what you've been hired to do. You know, a lot of stuff like that.
And you said you really did go into the triangle. I mean, it wasn't what you're going to be running in Toronto. You didn't really spend, it was more of everything else. For all the time you spent watching the triangle, studying it, it wasn't a big part of that conversation, right? Those 3 days?
No, not at all. Not at all, really. I mean, there was a little bit, but not much. I would say from a tactical standpoint, the one thing that stuck with me is he kept talking about pressure defense, like ball pressure, full court pressure, and, you know, and he played with the Knicks, how they used to full court press man to man and all this stuff. And it was good because it was a good kind of reemphasis. I mean, I kind of believe in that myself as you've, you know, watched our teams play. It was a good reemphasis and good to hear him talk about how important it was, you know.
And there's some things, I mean, on the surface, you know, the most basic difference in your backgrounds, he played in the NBA. You didn't play in the NBA, but there was a lot in common growing up in, you know, very rural areas, going to coach in the minor leagues. And both of you at different points before you got to the NBA or even for in your case, the D League, thinking about giving it up and just going to do something else. Those were a few parallels you felt with him.
Yeah. I think that intrigued me when I was watching those tapes in England or when I was reading his books and about his life. And I, you know, you did strike some commonalities there that, I don't know, maybe it keeps you going. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, maybe it keeps you going. You know, I don't know if you're verbalizing that to anybody. You're saying, you know, I'm going to be, you're never saying that, but you're maybe internalizing that a little bit or whatever. And I think there's a love of coaching there. You know, he's going to Puerto Rico. I'm going to England or Belgium or whatever. I love the minor leagues, you know, and he loved coaching in the minor league. And I loved it too. It's just there's something gritty and special about those players. And when they do make it, it's such a I don't know, celebration of coaching, really. That's what you do it for, you know, things like that. I don't know what else to say about that, really.
One thing too you got into in the book, Nick, is the idea that once you get to the NBA, unlike any other level of coaching and playing, that in a lot of ways the head coach is proving himself more to the players than the other way around, which is how it is in the minor leagues or Europe or even college basketball. I never quite heard it put that way, but boy, it's exactly right.
Yeah, I my first time, this was more even as an assistant, when I, my first time I walked up in front of the the team to give a scouting report as my first, when I was, 7 years ago as an assistant coach, I can't tell you how nervous I was, because it was rightly or wrongly so, I was thinking they were looking at me like, who the hell is this minor league guy, up here? But I was kind of used to it. Even when I got in front of my D-League teams, most of the guys were like, who the hell is this guy? but it is, you're under the gun. They want to be coached. Woj, I always say that, but they want to know that you know what you're doing and that you're going to put them a game plan out there that they can win with and they can succeed with both individually and as a team. And that's cause for some nervous feelings at the beginning sometimes. Yeah.
The 2024 NFL Draft heads to Detroit, and it's time to see who gets the job.
Caleb is a unique and special talent throwing the football.
And what sets them apart.
The Heisman Trophy winner is Jaden Daniels.
All of the greats were hired here.
What a throw by Mahomes.
See who gets the job.
Are you ready?
The 2024 NFL Draft begins Thursday, April 25th on ESPN, ABC, and NFL Network.
There's a great moment in your first season as head coach. Mid-November, you've lost three straight games. You're in Boston. You're in the film room. And some of the guys in the room are talking about the team's passing and how the ball was moving. And all of a sudden, there comes a voice in the room that you guys had not heard much from yet that season. Tell that story, Nick.
Yeah, we were talking about, moving the ball, getting a little bit more ball movement. I think that rolls off everybody's tongue all the time really easily, both coaches, players, media, fans, whatever. Boy, why don't they move the ball more? Or we should move the ball. And it was getting a lot of momentum, especially from the second unit guys and the guy, around. And the meeting was kind of picking up some momentum very strongly. And they were talking about, sometimes we just need to pass it for the hell of it, just to move it, just to circulate it, all those words that we use. Kawhi held up his hand and said, I can't really say this on air, but he said, I ain't passing for the bleep and hell of it. Whatever. He said, I'm not passing for the hell of it. And he said, my job's to score and then to draw double and triple teams. And when I do, then it's your job to score. And it was very well timed and very well said by him and important.
Because he didn't. In a lot of ways, it's the old E.F. Hutton commercial, right, with him.
Exactly.
I think people suspect that's what it's like with him, but that's how it really is.
100%. Yeah, 100%. He hadn't said much yet. He was still finding his feet and wondering about me as a coach, wondering about his teammates, wondering about some things. We were off to a pretty good start, though, but still, when we were in this, it's kind of the first team meeting. It was the first little bit of angst because we lost a couple in a row and all that kind of stuff. And he spoke up, and it really was everybody else in the whole film room looked up like, boy, we haven't heard that voice too much. And you could have heard a pin drop while he was speaking. And then when he delivered a haymaker line there. Right. Yeah. So that was again followed by a lot of silence of he's exactly right. And there's really nothing much more to say, end of meeting type of thing. Right.
The juxtaposition of Kawhi and Kyle Lowry, one guy who never talks unless he's got something profound he wants to share. And then there's Kyle, who never stops talking all the time. Right. It's an interesting. It was interesting. It had to be an interesting pairing, with those two together in that way.
For sure. I mean, Kyle is what Kyle. First of all, you sometimes he leads by example. There's no question. The guy plays hard, right? But he's also a vocal leader. Sometimes people say, well, he leads by example, which means he never says anything, right? But Kyle does lead by example and says quite a bit. But it ended up being a great pairing. But as you know, I'm not sure they really knew each other. Like, who knew Kawhi? Like I started coaching him. I'd never spoken to him before until we traded for him, And I think once they got to know each other as the season went on, tremendous amount of respect both ways, back and forth for those guys, even though they go about their leadership, you know, definitely the two leaders of the team, and they go about their leadership responsibilities a little bit differently.
One thing that I thought, especially for, I think, probably coaches at any level, maybe you have more leeway in this, perhaps at a lower level or a different level. You had a line in the book where you said that you've got six bullets to fire during a season. And essentially, you better use them pretty wisely and not waste them and use them on the most important things. What did that mean? That was something I think going into your first season as head coach, you thought. Did it turn out to be true? Are there actually more? Are there less? What did you learn about that coaching now two full seasons as a head coach in the NBA?
Yeah, I think it was less than that. But again, we had a good team. Right, I think we had a good team, so there was a lot of moments where maybe you would have, you know, got on them a little bit, but you kind of had a feeling things were going to be okay next time the ball went up. So you just kind of saved it, and I was really trying to save a lot of things for the postseason too. Woj, I was really letting my assistants coach, and I was kind of sitting back waiting so that again, I think in the book you're gonna see a. You know, I do think my voice is a finite resource during a season. So I try to save it and use it for when it's most impactful. And I think that six bullets thing is, you know, you can't be firing them all the time or they don't listen. Right.
I remember Steve Clifford telling me a story about Jeff Van Gundy told him Steve Clifford had just gotten the Division II job at Adelphi and Jeff was coaching the Knicks and he went to meet Jeff. To sit down with him, he figured out a way to get an audience with him. Obviously, Jeff ended up hiring him with the Knicks. But Jeff told him something that always stayed with Steve Clifford, which is, as a head coach, don't ever, essentially, when you have something to say to the team, it has got to be meaningful. And it can't be in practice, hey, let's play hard. Like when you say something, like to have any impact, it's you really got to pick your spots. And if you're just talking all the time and telling them everything's important, nothing's going to be important, right? You learn that probably, I would imagine that might be the case at almost any level.
Yeah, I think too, the NBA for me, Woj, is, when I first got in it as an assistant 7 years ago, I couldn't believe the pace. Couldn't believe that the games came and you got on a plane and then another game came and you got on a plane. I mean, it was like, and I think that the sheer quantity of work that's going on lends itself to you better pick your moments. I mean, you just can't be giving them tons of feedback constantly because there's so many games and they're happening quickly. And the next one's here and the next one's coming soon. But again, I really believe in letting the players play a little bit. I believe in letting my staff coach a little bit as well, right? You know, so I like to sit back and hopefully everybody understands the vision, which is closely tied to the plan, and it's being executed. And you can only step in when you don't think it's being executed, right?
To have a job, Nick, like the Toronto Raptors, where you walk in the door and the goal is to win a championship. They made you head coach because there was really one step left to take. And that's pretty rare in the profession. Usually you could probably make the case somebody with your background, non-ex player, a lot of minor leagues, then assistant G League, you're probably going to get a bad team. Typically your first job is going to be a bad team. Just the opposite for you. And not only do you get a good team, you win a championship, you go to the cusp of the conference finals again, you are set up with Pascal Siakam signed long-term, with Kyle still playing at a high level, with, you know, the hope of certainly re-signing Fred VanVleet, who's a free agent. I know Masai has made it clear that that's a priority to keep him in Toronto. Do you ever stop and think about just all the great coaches, guys you know that are really, really good coaches that you've competed with or that who get a job and you can kind of look at them and go, with that roster, good luck surviving 3 years, right? And this organization just plows through coaches year after year. How much do you think about that when you're able to step back and to have that kind of an opportunity and that kind of an organization with Masai and say, wow, boy, this worked out?
Yeah, I mean, listen, Woj, there's no doubt about it. I think about that often, about how, you know, well, grateful I am that I was kind of, listen, I love it here too, right? You get you skipped a bunch of stuff. Not only is our team great and Masai's great and our ownership, I mean, there's a lot of ownership, but Toronto is a fabulous place to live. The ride that we took the country on the way to that championship, and like how many millions of basketball fans we created in literally two series. You know, I think half the country was watching and the other half started once we got to the conference finals and fell in love with the team and the sport. So there's so much to be. I tell everybody this all the time, that this place is unique. It's always been unique, but it's like a really good unique, and it continues to be because of that. So I don't know. I'm kind of an international guy. I've lived in a few countries and I kind of like the spirit of the cultural diversity here in Toronto. I like the spirit of cultural diversity in our organization, our staff, the team. Yeah, but I'm lucky, and I try not to. I hope I don't forget that very often, that how fortunate I was to be given such a good team and a good job.
How much, Nick, and listen, you got used to it in the bubble, which was playing without fans and playing in an empty building. And, you know, listen, there's a lot of great environments in the NBA. There are a lot of them. Toronto is at the very top. And especially with what you've experienced the last couple of years there, it was electric to go to a game there and to go outside and see tens of thousands of people packed together outside your arena. And like, there's going to be this process of when can there be fans in an arena again and how many can you have in there? But you think about outside of your arena and you go, when could we ever see that again? How long is that away again? And it's an environment I think everybody wants to get back to in the league, but there's just so much uncertainty about when it's ever going to feel like that again or look like that again.
Yeah. I think, you know, people asked me about the, you know, game 7, Boston, it should have been at home. Was that a big factor? Yeah. Okay. Maybe, but what the factor is like you just said, the electricity that and energy and positivity that a city feels when there's a game 7 thumping in town coming up, you know, for the days leading up to it, the day of it, everybody in the streets, that's what was a factor. Mm-hmm. Like we were all under the same conditions in the bubble, but I'm saying that, you know, the people of this city and this country missed that energy and electricity and whatever. That's what's the biggest shame, I think. But I don't know. I think we're a long ways away from getting back to that. Woj, I think like you and me and everybody else, and I think just the casual Raptors fan is longing for that, because even when you're watching it on TV, you know, you see a shot of everybody outside, you know, dancing in the streets is uplifting for everybody that's even sitting in their living room, apartment, or wherever to see it. So,
I mean, it's funny. You think about, like, I was thinking about Luka Doncic's shot to beat the Clippers in the bubble for Dallas, and it wasn't an elimination game and it didn't decide a series. But it was probably as dramatic of a final second playoff shot as, you know, we had seen certainly since Kawhi's last year against Philly. And just think of how different that Luka shot would have looked in an arena with fans. And the Kawhi shot, what made it was, yeah, the ball bouncing on the rim, but how he gets enveloped by the fans there in the corner and the reaction. And boy, it is a profound difference in how you even remember a moment.
Well, for sure. It's like the picture of Kawhi down and the ball going through, many times you're scanning through the crowd and you're looking for people, you know, and seeing what they were doing. And You know, my son Leo missed it. He was looking the other way, but he's only three. We'll forgive him for that. But so there's that's the magic, right? Woj of sports when you see, you know, it's like Jordan when he hit that shot in Utah and the crowd and, you know, just all that stuff that's history, right? That's what history, that those shots and those pictures, you know, freeze a moment in time.
Yeah, it sure does. Nick, congratulations on your foundation. You guys, I know you're doing great work with it. The Nick Nurse Foundation, you can find it online. It's nicknursefoundation.org.
That's it. Yeah.
Right. Nick nursefoundation.org. You can see the work they're doing, and a teacher in the Toronto area a music teacher who you guys got on Zoom with and let her know that she was going to get $25,000 worth of musical equipment. And her reaction is pretty awesome. And then the release of your new book, Rapture, 15 Teams, 4 Countries, 1 NBA Championship, and How to Win Damn Near Anywhere. That is out. That is probably about as long of a title, Nick, as I've seen anybody fit on a cover. So good work with that. But the book's a lot of fun. I've enjoyed it. I'm looking forward to finishing it. There's a lot to, I think, for Raptor fans, NBA fans, broader. It's about a lot more than just one team and one coach. So thanks for taking time out, Nick. It's always great to be with you, man.
Thanks a lot, Woj. Really enjoyed it. Always fun. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Woj Pod. A big thank you to our guest, Toronto Raptors coach Nick Nurse. You can listen to new and archived episodes of the Woj Pod wherever you get your podcasts. And be sure also to listen to The Low Post with Zach Lowe and The Hoop Collective with Brian Windhorst. We'll catch you soon.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this? A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package. Terms and restrictions apply.